Perfect reading while sipping a pint of Five Points beer in a remarkable pub is a book called East End Pubs. It is a wonderful book that will transport you to 65 of East London's boozers of distinction. London pub explorer Alistair Von Lyon and photographer Tim George will take you on a journey revealing the spirited communities created by the landladies and landlords at the helm of these treasured institutions. To get your hands on a copy, visit hoxtonminipress.com. Or if you're in the East End, drop into the Brick Lane Bookshop or Rough Trade Records in the Old Truman's Brewery. East End Pubs. Perfect reading while sipping a pint of Five Points beer in a remarkable pub.
A ticket check is about to commence. Please have your tickets or passes ready for inspection.
If you like stories about entrepreneurs, you're in for a treat. But if you like stories about entrepreneurs and buses and pubs, you're in for a real treat.
I'm Elton Mooner, and I'm at a canal side recording studio in East London waiting for my guest. I'm with Paolo, the sound engineer. He is here and he has offered to collect my guest from reception. So if you just hold on for a second while I explain to Paolo what he looks like. Right, Paolo, he's 6'4", probably wearing a jacket that's seen slightly better years. He will almost definitely have a cravat on. He's 80 years old, but doesn't look 80. He's, I don't know, how else can I describe him? He's got a sort of presence, a bit of grandeur about him. He may have a crash helmet because he might have driven his moped here. His name is Robert, but it's just a 6'4" man, grandeur, cravat. Okay, he's out there. Great.
Yeah, I'm going to get him then.
So whilst Paolo collects him, let me tell you a little bit about my guest. You'll be meeting a man who has represented Great Britain in the Olympics. He was a history teacher. He ran a double-decker bus business exporting London double-decker buses to America. And he is the godfather of London pubs. He's built an estate of predominantly freehold London pubs worth well over 30 million quid. Now, if you're not in the pub world, if pubs and hospitality is not your sector, you wouldn't know his name. Why would you? But if you are in the pub world, pubs and hospitality is your sector, I guarantee you, you won't know his name either, despite the fact that he's influenced many, many other pub entrepreneurs and he's influenced big companies in equal measure. His name? It's Robert Thomas. And in his own way, while shunning the trade press, ignoring convention, overcoming obstacles, has built something extremely special. Remarkable pubs, as I say. A predominantly freehold estate of 17 London pub gems. They're pubs that have that real essence of what makes a really good pub. So we're waiting for Paolo to get him. I don't mind telling you privately now, as he's not here yet, as Robert's not here yet, that I have a great respect for this man. What he's done, how he's achieved it is fascinating. And to be frank, I'm a little in awe of him. But I'm not sure if I'm in awe in a good way. Sometimes when I'm with him, I feel like a schoolboy summoned to a headmaster's office. I get a bit kid-like. But let's keep that to ourselves, shall we? Paolo will be bringing Robert through the door any minute now. So sit back, get yourself a cup of tea or a beer or something like that, because in a tick, he will be with us. Hold tight, hold tight.
There he is. Hello, Robert.
I mean, are we filming things here as well?
We're talking. We're going to just talk.
Oh, good. Okay.
Good to see you.
Very well. Yeah, lovely. Thanks, pal. I'll take my coat off.
So, Robert, look, before I talk to you about your life of Olympics and teaching and double-decker buses and adventure and building that pub empire, I know for a fact there is at least one entrepreneur listening to this who wants to build a business like you've built. In any sector, he wants to see it grow. He's got a vision like you. He's inspired. He's got the energy. He's got all of those things. But he's going to mess it all up, or she, if they don't get money right. How have you handled money over the years?
I learnt my first lesson from a chap at the old Midland Bank in Chancery Lane. This must be in the middle 60s I first got going. And we made a presentation to him with an accountant, proposition. And he liked the proposition and he said, one question, Mr. Thomas, how do you intend to repay me? Fortunately, we had a little cash flow forecast. So very important, cash flow forecasts, do the homework with the bank. You're only going to get money from the bank unless you're lucky enough to have family money, which I didn't. And you always hope that your proposition works. What I do is fill out a cash flow forecast form each time I do something. And I look at the plus side and then the minus side. And if the minus side tells me you're not going to get out of this without a problem, don't do the plan. And the question which I always asked when I was first in business was, how do people actually make it? How can they get past this initial hurdle of the problem with money?
Yeah.
You've got to have money. How do you do that? You've got to have a bit of luck. And all the way through my career, business career, I've had that bit of luck. Of course, as one bank manager told me, Robert, you make your own luck.
Robert Leo Thomas, you were born on Monday, the 19th of April, 1943. It was an era of wartime rationing. However, things were beginning to look up. Now, there was a Greek philosopher who said, give me a child until he is seven, and I will show you the man. So a lot of people say that the first 7 years shapes the man or shapes the woman.
Goodness. I had quite a eventful 7 years. My father had a run-in with the law during the war. He was a retail butcher. And unfortunately, they found sort of some frozen lambs on the roof of his butcher's shops, which shouldn't have been there.
Hmm.
So he lost his job, and we moved to Ireland, I think, when I was about six or seven. Then all failed business. My father was a business person, but they failed, and he kept on failing in all these sorts of things he did. He was a person who was an intelligent person, but he had no education, left school at 14, as a lot of people did in those days. And so I'd say my time from one to seven was peppered with disappointment. But travel. I came from a loving family. We traveled all over the place. We ended up in Bristol, finally. Back in Bristol, after going to, let me think, we went to Ealing in London, and then we went to the Isle of Wight, all on businesses, butcher shops, which failed. And finally ended up in Bristol in 1951, as I recall, when I was eight, I suppose, yes, seven or eight. And then went to the local primary school.
Now your mum, she had a hairdressing business, I believe, as well.
She did, yes. So she was a court hairdresser, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And she started the business at home in 1958 or 59.
Hmm.
Yeah, they were sort of business-oriented people, but in a small way.
So business-orientated. Your father had some failures with his business.
Yeah.
Your mother's hairdressing business...
was a success,
was
yes.
a success, yeah. And... Was there, because you've got a strong work ethic, you know, you're a hard-working person who...
Well, I don't know about that, and I often think, well, yes, I was hard-working in my younger years.
Yeah.
But I found out later on the road to success was more contemplation than actual work. There was that ethos in Britain.
Focus,
hard work is the answer. Well, at some level, it's not. When I say hard work, I mean actual work out there doing and playing and I suppose cerebral work is what I'm talking about. Yeah, I still work every day with cerebellum.
So I suppose it depends how you define hard work, but there seem to be from both your mother and father a work ethic. One was quite successful, the other, due to circumstances, less successful.
Yes.
Your father was a bit of a rule breaker. Somebody described you as a rule breaker, which I'm going to talk to you about in a little while longer, because I want to try and get to the bottom of that. But after your childhood, it must have been a reasonably tough era. Pluck and spirit, I would imagine, would be essential ingredients. But at that time, there was a sort of new middle class emerging. And somebody spoke to me when I was doing my research for this, talked about your persona, your charisma, your humour, your presence. And I know your grandma trod the boards, I believe.
Yeah, she was a tiller girl.
She was a tiller girl, yeah.
Like the Speaker of the House of Commons, who died recently. I've forgotten her name.
Betty Boothroyd.
Betty Boothroyd, yeah.
And you know, I've there's something almost theatrical about you. You're a big man. You've almost got, don't take this the wrong way, but a sort of charming awkwardness. You've definitely got charisma. Was there any influence? I hear that things like The Goon Show, Tony Hancock, Peter Sellers, Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick's film, those sorts of things that you like. Did you base any of you on that?
No, I suppose my father. My father was a wag. Yes, he used to command attention. His boast, his claim was that it wasn't a pub in Bristol that he visited that where someone wouldn't say, "Hello, Tom," you know.
Yeah.
In fact, somebody called him Lord Tom.
Yeah.
So he was a funny man too. Yeah, he had lots of jokes, and so I think that obviously rubbed off on my character and personality.
Yeah. How brilliant. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the Olympics, and we're talking about swimming and buses and all sorts of things like that. Back in a tick.
Okay.
Visit a remarkable pub and drink well. Five Points Brewing Company proudly supply remarkable pubs with beers including Five Points Pale, XPA and Juper. Would you like to stock Five Points beers in your pub? Send Will an email, will@fivepointsbrewing.co.uk. Five Points are proud to supply remarkable pubs and would be proud to serve you.
So, Robert Thomas, we have talked about your childhood and we've talked about your early years as you were growing up post-war. A couple of things I want to talk about now is, one is your buses business, where I think you really carved a niche for yourself and made a very successful business, but also Olympic swimming. Let's just throw that into the mix. Start wherever you wish.
Well, the whole thing started with my two brothers, actually. I had two older brothers, so there was huge kind of, from my side anyway, sibling rivalry. I wanted to show my two brothers. I'd like to have done it at school, but at a young age was not that keen. I hadn't really had the consciousness of the value of education at that age. I was probably 9, 10 or something like that. And it just so happened that when I was at primary school, a chap who's doing this swimming lessons, Hot Wells Baths in Bristol, came up to me one day and said, "Hey, oi, I'm starting a swimming club at Shirehampton Pool. Would you like to come along?" Sort of. And of course, I jumped at that idea. And over about, I joined the club when I was 10, I think. 5 years later, I was the national school's junior backstroke champion. So it took 5 years of training and applying myself. And I think the swimming has been the life lesson. It said to me, if you apply yourself and you've got a bit of talent, you can do it, whatever you want to do. So I ended up really in 1960 getting an Olympic trial and swim for Great Britain at the Olympics trials. And then prior to that, becoming a national champion, junior national champion, and Amateur Swimming Association, which is like the AAU. And then finally, the last title, national title I got, was the senior schools championships in 1955. So I got three national titles and a Great Britain cap.
You swim to this day?
Oh, yeah. I'm a master swimmer. Of course, for health reasons, and I've done it all my life. I've never given up swimming and water polo, play water polo. But yeah, I find it very healthy.
But you still swim to this day. What is it about swimming that you like? Is it the winning, the taking part, the fitness?
Having a goal, setting a goal, just like business, really. As I said earlier, and the swimming was the thing that taught me to how to apply myself, really.
Okay, well, that's brilliant. And how does it feel to have represented your country in the Olympics?
Well, not much, really. I can't say. It's such a long time ago, really.
I want to push you on that. I think it must mean something to you.
Well, I suppose the most satisfying thing were really the school I went to. At that time, not so much now, in fact, hardly at all now, swimming was on television in the summer practically every week. There'd be some, I think, because the BBC found it was cheap. And I used to be on the TV practically, you know, every month in the summer for about 3 or 4 years. So I was quite the hero at school. So that was kind of Philip, you know, being the hero at school. You know, people would stop me in the street after a while, which I found embarrassing, to be honest. Mm.
But you like,
so yeah, aren't you that go on bloke on the TV we see on the swimming and all that sort of thing? And they stopped me in the street for months afterwards. My main event, the one I won the nationals, like 8 million people watched it, which was the figures in those days. You know, the national championships were always on TV on a Friday evening, and I came back to Bristol after winning that, and then for weeks afterward, people would stop me in the street.
And what did that feel like? The recognition?
It was faintly embarrassing, to be honest with you.
What kind of embarrassing?
I don't know. I can't describe it. I'm sure actors have it all the time. It's kind of embarrassing, you know. Did you set out with the idea of becoming a champion and having all that? Yeah, you did. But you weren't really aware of what it might do to you, you know, in terms of people coming up in the street and saying, here, you are that blue, you know. I was faintly embarrassed. Of course, it's always nice to win, isn't it? It's something I was good at, I suppose. And better than my two brothers.
So there's a bit of...
My brother was a boxer, you know. And
yeah.
He spent more time on the canvas than he did fighting anybody. So.
Well, that's good. That's an interesting interesting thought. So you had two brothers. You were the eldest.
Youngest.
The youngest. Okay, yeah. So there was a little
that's
bit of...
That's where the sibling rivalry
That's where the sibling
from.
Rivalry yeah. came. Okay.
They used to say, what you done? You know, well, you'll never do anything. Tin ribs. I remember tin ribs they used to call me. I was very skinny when I was a kid, you know. Tin yeah. ribs. Whoa.
So you had a bit to prove.
Exactly, yes. Mm. That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you did.
And I did, yeah.
How does that feel?
When it actually happened, I was like getting elderly at that stage, 17, so, you know, and the training and everything I'd done with it, I mean, the sibling rivalries kind of receded at that stage. So, I'm just pleased that the family were pleased, and they were pleased, obviously. Mm-hmm. Seeing my parents seeing their son on TV and so on, had an impact.
When it comes to business, let's just talk about business and principles and values. Could you just go through how you, in terms of money, your principles and values on that, Robert?
Well, as I say, don't lie to anybody if you owe them money or, you know, or you've got a problem. Keep integrity at the forefront, because if you don't, someone will trip you up sooner or later and you'll fall flat on your face and people won't trust you anymore. You won't be able to borrow any money. No one. I mean, I'm talking about suppliers, employees, everybody. Keep everything as straight as you possibly can. You make mistakes, of course you do, you know. But when you do, take the ethical way out, always. Because you'll get repaid for that later on. Someone will say, you owed me this, but he came to see me. He said he wouldn't be able to pay me for 6 weeks instead of four. He paid on the 6 week and did it or whatever, you know. And my bus business taught me a lot about that.
Let's talk about your bus business, Robert.
Well, it was an awful business. It was tough as hell. I had no money. I started in America in 1967. My then wife was at MIT doing a doctorate in psychology or something. And she supported me. And I got into this business of selling buses through a whole convoluted set of circumstances, which are too long to go into here. Basically, we had to buy buses in England, finance them, ship them out, okay, get them to America, deliver them to the customer. And we did that with a small deposit. I think we were able to get 25%. Well, the shipping fee alone would have takes care of that. The buses were about $2,000 each to ship. So on and so forth. Remember, I had no money, nothing. Hmm. So it was done by getting contracts from my customer, going to the bank and borrowing money on those. And that was hard to do because the bank managers would say, how do you know he's going to pay you? How do you know you're going to... And so I had to produce all kinds of proof that he would. Fortunately, in the beginning especially, I had grade A customers, people like TWA, Pan Am. We had Anheuser-Busch, which is now InBev.
Hmm.
And I had really, really good customers and signed up properly with a contract. So that really is what got me going. Really.
And how did you find those customers? I want to go actually back to your charm and your charisma and your confidence and that persona.
Well, there wasn't any charm or charisma or confidence in this. It was just a stroke of luck. When I say luck, I'm sorry, maybe I'm using luck too much. A piece of good judgment.
A piece of good judgment.
I had studied advertising technique a little bit, and it occurred to me that people in the top jobs in America tended to buy the Wall Street Journal, and they had a page every week, can't remember what day it was, I think it was a Wednesday, called The Mart, and they had classified advertising in there. So I put a classified advert in there, because that was my audience, these business people. You know, now the readership, comparatively speaking, was nothing. I don't know, hundreds of thousands compared with, say, New York Times or Time Magazine, which had millions. But I could put an ad in those organs and not get a result. There would be no result there. But in the Wall Street Journal, that target audience, my 3-inch ad pulled 600 replies the first time I put it in. 600 replies. Mm. I couldn't believe it, but flooded in by letter, phone, everything else. Yeah, I've seen your ad. Can you send us some information about your buses? And out of that came our first orders, quite good orders.
So that's not luck. That's good, that judgment,
was good judgment,
isn't it?
At that time, yes. But it was just a question, in this case, my education. You know, obviously read a lot and what are you trying to do? Advertise. Look up some advertising technique. That's how I got going.
And people are fantastic. You know, you've got your target.
Oh, by the
audience.
Way, I had to get credit from Wall Street Journal on the first ad. I couldn't afford to pay it. It was quite a lot of money, probably $3,000 or something, which I didn't have. But I managed to talk the lady around. Maybe that's where charm and my English accent helped in America. Yeah, maybe.
There is something about you, Robert, that has that ability to... I could imagine not wanting to buy a bus, but having spoken to you, I'd want to buy one, and I'm sure that lots of other people may have been in that way.
I don't know.
Influenced by that way.
I've no idea. All I know is at that time, Britain was considered to be extremely fashionable for Americans. Buses, British buses, you know, they wanted to be part of that. Beatles and, you know, Swinging London, was it called? And they wanted to be part of that fashion. So in a way, again, I was lucky with the timing.
Well, there we are. We're going to take a very short break, and then we are going to come back,
right,
and we're going to talk about your beloved wife, your dear wife, Jean.
Yes, right.
Perfect reading while sipping a pint of Five Points beer in a remarkable pub is a book called East End Pubs. It is a wonderful book that will transport you to 65 of East London's boozers of distinction. London pub explorer Alistair Von Lyon and photographer Tim George will take you on a journey revealing the spirited communities created by the landladies and landlords at the helm of these treasured institutions. To get your hands on a copy, visit hoxtonminipress.com. Or if you're in the East End, drop into the Brick Lane Bookshop or Rough Trade Records in the Old Truman's Brewery. East End Pubs. Perfect reading while sipping a pint of Five Points beer in a remarkable pub.
Yes, I'm with Robert Thomas, and we're talking about his career. We've got to the point where you met your wife. You always describe her as your beloved wife,
yes,
Jean.
She was a lovely person, yeah.
You went on to build a business with her,
yes,
a pubs business. Can you tell me about Jean?
Well, Jean was an artist. She'd gone to the Bath Academy of Art, and she just had good taste. And I think in the pub business, particularly today, that's what's required. For years, the breweries had kind of lost any direction with regard to design, with honourable exceptions. She was instrumental in focusing me on design and good taste. Well, taste, as you know, is subjective. However, I think it goes through fashions and everything else. But in the terms of pubs, we were dealing with wonderful, in most cases, wonderful architectural specimens of a certain period. So we just wanted to get it right from that perspective. And she helped me enormously with that.
Mm. So you had a...
And she was supportive, in fact, with our ambitions. If we found something, I know that some people would have said, oh, no, you've got enough on your plate, don't do any more, we don't need the money, whatever. But if I found a place which was of interest to us, she would always support me. And I think that was terribly important.
Mm. So you had an interest in buildings and in architecture. Jean had a real eye for detail, for the
colours,
interiors,
and
real artistic
fabric.
Flair.
It was turned out in the end, into paradoxically, to be very simple. Mm. Don't make it too flowery, you know, make it simple. Yeah.
I'm going to talk to you about your first pub in a moment, but just before that, I want to take you to 87 Knowle Road in Islington, to a Victorian Grade II listed pub, the Island Queen.
Oh, yes.
I think that was an influence for both of you.
That was an inspiration, yes. It was run by a chap called John Evans, that's right. And he had an eye, or at least he had a girlfriend who had an eye. She also was a very talented artist. I think she was from one of the art colleges. And she did all sorts of wonderful things with that pub. You can still see them online. Go to the Island Queen with stuffed mannequins and statues and colour, this and that. So we were inspired by that in the beginning.
And what sort of people went to the Island Queen? What sort of customers?
It was full of artists, and Pink Floyd people were in there. They had a studio around the corner in Britannia Mews. Roger Waters, all those sort of types. A lot of arty sort of people be in there.
So an eclectic mix of people, old
Very
Victorian
eclectic,
pub.
Yeah, all sorts, and some villains.
Yeah.
All sorts, really. But I think the overwhelming ethos was artistic, I would have said.
Yeah. So a real blend of different people.
Yeah.
At this point, you hadn't bought a pub.
No.
So tell me about that.
Well, I had my bus business in America, and we'd had a bit of luck here and there sending buses around to other countries from London, actually, including Japan, which is a very tough market.
Interesting to your use of word luck again, but anyway, carry on.
Yeah, okay. Well, in this case, we'd only copied what we'd done in America. I put another little 3-inch ad in the Financial Times, which did the same thing.
Hmm.
Pulled in business interests. Yeah. So I'd made a bit of money, and I bought a house in Hackney, Albion Drive, and was doing that up. Found another house. I mean, we're talking about 1977, 78, 79, that era. You could buy houses in Hackney for £10,000. And Jean and I had been developing a house around the corner to turn into two flats, which we did, sold them. So we were on to... No, and she came back one day. She'd been doing some work for the government, something she got involved with. I can't remember exactly what it was. She said, I passed this pub, she said, today in Park Holm Road. She said, I looked, put my head round the door. There's no one in there. And I said, oh, yeah. She said, make three lovely flats. This is the Prince George. I said, well, we're going to have a look at it then. Yeah, let's go and have a look. And we went down there. A couple of evenings, no one there, you know. So, end of the week, we called up Whitbread. There's a big sign outside, Whitbread. You know, phoned up their property department, which at that time was based at Luton, I think. We phoned this number in Luton, spoke to a nice chap there, Prince George, Park Holm Road. Any chance of us acquiring this building, buying it, you see? He said, well, we don't sell pubs. Not our policy. I said, but there's no one in there. He said, yeah, it's a tenancy. I said, oh, sorry. He said, yeah, someone rents it from you, because I didn't know anything about pubs. I mean, how it worked exactly. I knew there were tenants and freeholders and so on, free houses. I knew that, but I knew very little about the mechanics of pubs. I said, well, we're interested in buying it. He said, well, it's not for sale, sorry. He said, but what I will do, I'll put your name down, and if we change our mind, I'll get in touch with you. About 6 weeks went by, or longer, 3 months, I think it was. The phone rang one day, this chap said, Mr. Thomas, yes, are you still interested in the Prince George? I said, yeah. I thought he meant it's for sale. Hmm. So he said, yes. I said, well, how much do you want for it? He said, well, it's not exactly for sale. He said, but the tenancy's available. I said, well, we're really only interested in developing it, you know, as three flats. He said, well, so I was kind of curious at that. Something went bing in my head. I said, well, what sort of rent are you looking for on a place like that, you know? Little bit of background. The pubs locally were very poor. So perhaps right at the back of my head was thinking, maybe we should get a pub and do something people like. Instead of being bullied by these guys around here. So I said, how much is the rent you're looking for? He said, well, we're looking for £100 a week. And I don't know what, you know, I didn't think about it. I didn't do anything. All I, something went bing in my head. I said, okay, we'll take that. And now I'm a pub tenant. You know, they said, well, we've got to come and interview. Gene and I went for an interview. And these guys, about seven of them, were asking us these questions about pubs and so on. Anyway, we ended up acquiring the Prince George. Went in there, did some bits of this, decorated and so on. Spent a little bit of money on it, not a lot. And it's practically as you see it today. We didn't change it. Simple things, right colour wallpaper, bare floors. We were one of the first pub companies, I think, to do bare floors. They had carpets in those days, and we didn't like the carpets, so we did bare floors. And things like, little innovations like that. Anyway, I must tell you a side story that we went back to see the landlord, a chap called John Stewart. And we noticed on the bar there were all these sort of keg products. The one I remember most of all was called Tankard. Whitbread Tankard and others, all. I said, excuse me, I said, you know, because we used to like real ale in those days, as people do today, you know, it became fashionable. I said, don't people want the stuff that you pull the pump with, the real ales? Oh, he said, there's no demand for it round here, Gov. He said, you know, we did have a couple that used to like it. I got it in for them, but they went to Basildon. They moved to Basildon, you see. I said, well, what about the people up and down this road? Because Parcombe Road, as you know, is a lovely road. All the ones with the, you know, scaffolding outside. Who said they wouldn't come in here?
Scaffolding, as in they are refurbishing their...
Yeah, the new people coming in.
Yeah, new people coming in, yeah.
So, we did our job and did a mailing around the area, opened up, and I had six real ales installed on the bar. And by 8 p.m. on our opening evening, we'd sold the lot, which meant I had to go up in my car the next day to a brewery in Kentish Town, which was their place at that time. I don't know what it is now. And we replaced all the beers, and we didn't look back. We sold, we were known for real ales. That's how it got going.
So at this
point,
there was no
demand for it, you see.
No. You proved him wrong. And at this point, were you the tenant, or had you...
Tenant,
you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Remained the tenant for, God, 20-odd years. Paid rent for all that time until the crash came in 2008.
Oh, and you bought it then, in 2008?
Well, the Enterprise Inns were going broke, if you recall.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the pub codes, and so they wanted to download it. So we bought that, and the... And the swimmer at that time.
Mm. So you've got this beautiful pub. You're a tenant. Some of the influences that Gene put are still there to this day. Your cask ale is in. You know, the pub is flying. And you went on to buy. Well, you know, in the introduction when you weren't here, I was talking to the people listening, and I said you've amassed a pub empire, if you like, of I don't know, roughly 30 million quid. So how did you manage? What were the next steps to that? You were in the Prince George.
Well, being an observer of the property market, obviously, I had some background with that in Hackney at that time. I noticed there were these huge fluctuations according to the where the economy was going. So I used to wait for a trough. And a trough came in, I think it was 91 or 92, terrible trough. And a pub in Stoke Newington came up, the Shakespeare. And it had been on the market for 4 or 5 months, no one wanted it. And we bought that was our first acquisition. And it went on from there, and we again did a job on in there. You've seen the stuff in there, you know, the posters, and then, you know, people like that.
Yeah, when you say posters, not like a poster you would find in a pub now, but the beautiful artwork that's behind the bar of the man pouring a liqueur, I think it is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And some artwork from your
Jake had done
stepson.
That. Done that. And we got a sort of effigy on the wall, a lady holding a ball, stuff like that.
Yeah. Does that go back to the Arlen Queen influence there?
It does, yes. Yeah. You've spotted that, that's right. And, of course, with Gene and other things. By that time, I'd acquired a book, too, which we'd cribbed a lot. It was Victorian Pubs. And there was a lot of stuff, a lot of information in there, which we used and copied.
Mm. And tell me about your relationship with Gene. It's almost that you were kind of opposites but connected.
Well, opposites attract. I'm outgoing, and she was very introverted and quiet.
Yeah.
But she was the sort of person who could kill with one eyelash at 50 yards, you know.
Mm.
If she didn't like something, that was her way of expressing displeasure. Mm. She'd never say anything, but I could tell if she was displeased.
you may well walk out of this lovely East London Canalside studio when I ask you this next question, but one person I spoke to said that occasionally you could be a little like a, shall I say this? I will, bull in a china shop, but Gene would very calmly kind of just in your wake would kind
of
just
calm. Yeah, well, I get enthusiastic about things, yes, that's right. But I think that's correct. I think any entrepreneur who isn't enthusiastic about a project should, you know, go back to school teaching or whatever.
Mm. Mm. No, that's good. Mm. And Gene sadly passed away.
Unfortunately, he had breast cancer.
Mm.
Mm. Terrible.
I've known you for a while, Robert. I've noticed every time you speak about Jean, you call her your beloved wife.
Yes, she was beloved, very much so. Yeah.
So we've got to the point where you had the Prince George, then you purchased the second one in Stoke Newington, and then you gradually built up. Could you give us a sort of potted version of how
the Prince George for a long time was a wonderful hobby and a drinking hole for us and get to know the neighbours and so on. I didn't really consider it to be, you know, a business that maybe I'd be in for all my life. It was a kind of a hobby at that time, and a fun hobby.
Hmm.
I had a manager. Of course, I was doing my bus business. I couldn't run it myself. And then as my bus business wound down, because we weren't able to get the material that we liked, briefly, we used the old half-cab buses, which were a very beautiful thing to my view, from London Transport and other places. And gradually, all those buses were being replaced with a sort of shoebox on wheels, a flat-fronted, non-pleasing vehicle that wasn't of no interest to me.
Hmm.
And so as we were winding down over those periods of time, I thought, well, you've got to do something else now. And I could have stayed in the bus business had I decided to go into the sightseeing business. The sightseeing in America became huge. We started it in New York in 83. I was called by American Airlines, and they wanted six buses to do touring around New York, advertising their new London service. They'd bought the rights to fly into Heathrow from TWA, who went bankrupt eventually. I said, I don't want to do that, you know, but I can find somebody. And I found somebody who wanted to take on. I sold the buses to American Airlines. They passed it on to this guy who operated a sightseeing service. And it was a huge success. And if I'd stayed in that business, using the flat-fronted buses, I could have done equally well. But it had no interest to me whatsoever.
Didn't interest
you. It was just making money, and I wasn't really interested in that. That didn't really interest me. Apart from the fact that I'm fed up with America, I wanted to come home. You know, I'd had my fill as a young person in America, wanted to come home to England, sit in corners and have a nice pint of real ale. It's what I consider to be very pleasing. So when the Shakespeare came up, that's when I decided, well, I'm going to stay in this business now. It's a good business, because it's two businesses, isn't it? Pub business. You've got the one business, the retail selling of the product, the beer, and then by the side of it, you've got the increase in the value of the property if your business improves. So, you know, that was great. You know, money came in every day.
Yeah. So you've got these two pubs, and then what happened after that? Where did the third and fourth, the fifth come from?
Goodness. Well,
you're up to 17 now.
That's right.
And yeah. I must say at this point, dear listener, Robert is he's just over 80 years old. He's just bought another pub. But let me take you back to that third one that you...
Well, then there was a huge recession, and the Rosary Branch came up. For some reason, I couldn't borrow the money, and didn't want to, really. I had Cecilia and Julian, friends of mine, and I knew Cecilia was interested in dance and theatre and things like that. So I said, are you interested in going in halves on a pub? I said, it's got a theatre, dance. Oh, yes, please. So she came up with some money, and I think I borrowed some money from her to do it, and paid her back within short time. And we got going with that one.
Which today is a thriving pub with a thriving theatre.
Well, it is, yeah. It's very, very successful.
So you had the Rosie, the Rosemary Branch.
Yeah, and then later on, we had the Royal Inn came on. Interesting pub. Nice little story about it. Somebody got murdered in there. Chap was sitting in there. Someone came in with a shotgun, shot him, killed him apparently. Awful. And the tenants left. It was owned by Her Majesty. It was the Crown Estate property. They wanted rid of it. Came on the market. I phoned up Cecilia. I didn't really need the money from Cecilia at the time, but I felt, you know, they'd been kind enough to involve me in that one. I at least offered them the opportunity to invest with this one, which they did. So we ended up buying that. Gene and some other people said, "Ooh, do you really want a pub where someone got shot?" Well, you know, we're in Hackney. We know what the problems are, but we hopefully turn them around by turning them into attractive places, you know, by sending signals out in them, you know, that certain people find attractive, others don't.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gene said, well, do we really want... I said, well, look, if we don't buy it, somebody else will. And look at that location. And she agreed. And I said, anyway, I said, we can rename it. What? I said, we'll call it the Shot in the Park, which went down like a lead balloon.
I could imagine, Robert.
Anyway, that was just one funny little thing we did. And that took off and became very successful.
Well, it went from there to what it is today, of 17 predominantly freehold pubs.
Yeah, but two leases left. The remainder are all freehold. And when you say bank borrowings, I think our gearing is, oh, I don't know, something silly, about 5% or something. Now. Yeah. I managed to pay back a lot.
So that goes right back to when we started this podcast.
In fact, I don't
talking
have
about
any gearing
money.
At the moment. I've got the money. I made some money, which I put on deposit with Barclays, which I'll redeem shortly. When I redeem that, I'll have no debt at all.
Debt-free.
Amazing. Debt-free, yeah. I've done that, however, because I've got these freeholds, which I bought for nothing, you know, in fairness. So,
yeah.
I had the good judgment, not the luck.
Bit of both, maybe.
Buy them, maybe. I didn't, honestly, nobody knew. You couldn't tell. Even now, you can't tell whether a pub is going to be successful. You have to do, a lot of kind of sniffing in the air, and you're looking at them. Go around the neighbourhood, that's the best thing.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to your father, and I think you freely told me that he was a rule breaker. But somebody described you, when I was doing my research, as a rule breaker. They very quickly added he's squeaky clean when it comes to totally above board when it comes to HMRC or licensing or employment laws, but still described you as a rule breaker. And I couldn't quite get to the bottom of that. What do you think that person meant?
I have no idea. I can only think of that as going out on a limb and buying something which I have no idea whether they're going to be successful, I think.
Yeah.
That's what they probably mean. Risk taker, they should maybe have said.
This person, I won't say male or female, otherwise you might know who it is, said that one of your famous lines is, don't just think about it, pick up the phone and do it.
Yeah, that's right. Action, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah. So maybe rule breaker is not the...
No, I don't think it is. I think it's risk-taking. Use your intuition, if you can. Intuition is very important, I think.
Mm.
And you know you have a feeling about something. And as I say, by no means I'm fallible. Mm. Sometimes you see something, you just know that's going to be a set. Don't even hesitate. Do it.
Just do it.
If you get that feeling, you know.
Yeah.
Which hopefully, and in my case, mostly has been correct.
Mm.
But they are, you know, can't guarantee it.
I do see you as a cautious man, though, when you talk about your money and you talk about how you've developed the business. So yeah. there is, you know, you will definitely go and do things, but it probably goes back to that what you said about weighing up. What's the best case scenario? What's the worst case scenario?
Yes.
Will I survive with the worst case scenario?
Exactly.
So yeah. It could well be that, but I do notice a caution.
I like sleeping at night too. I don't like money worries.
No,
I had them all my life with my family.
Yeah.
You know, gas bill. I haven't paid the gas bill. They're going to turn the gas bill off. Rates. We haven't paid the rates. Get down. If somebody looks through the letterbox, yeah, this sort of thing. I never wanted to go there.
No.
Ever.
So it's amazing, isn't it? We go back again into the beginning of the podcast when we were looking at your years, you know, your early years, how they have influenced you right up to
this
day.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. How can I put this? You don't suffer fools gladly.
I have done.
however, there is a circle of people in your life that have been with you for a long time that you trust. Tell me about those people. Some of the people who work in your business.
Yeah, well, I think it boils down to the fact that we've always paid very well. We use an incentive system, as you know, to employ our managers. They're always on a percentage of the turnover. And some of them have done very well, and they know that they're going to get paid, and they know that they have, you know, integrity behind it, whatever it might be. And I'll do what I consider to be the right thing, always. I think that helps.
So you treat your managers well. What about some of the people who've been in your business for a long time? So the person who looks after your finances, the people who, your architect, your builders, etc. You know, you've been with them for a long, long time.
Yes. Well, the people that I rely on have good taste. And maybe they're not the fastest and the cheapest, but they are, in the end, the best.
Yeah. And mentors in your life, is there anybody there... you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Was your mother a mentor with her hairdressing business, the way she worked? Or is there people in the public eye who have been mentors for you? Or people you respect?
Well, I suppose it must have been family connected. They always wanted to have a business that was successful. Never did. Not really. So I was kind of anxious to put that right. But as far as the mentoring in my business career, the one person that mentored me, I think, would be Jeff Graham, who was my economics master at school, who introduced me to the work of J.M. Keynes. In my view, the man who saved capitalism and certainly saved the West. And we could have had a Russian kind of government by now without him, because he put his finger on how to save things during the Depression. He was the man who sort of thought up the idea of deficit spending and stuff like that. And for me, completely liberated me from the fear of money. He he postulated that money was just an abstract, which I hadn't considered. In my family, money had an intrinsic value. Money was money. Of course, it's not. It's a totally abstract thing. Well, this information at the age of 16, when I was in the fifth form, was like sixth form, was quite incredible, quite revolutionary to me. So he would have mentored me, because I had no fear of money, only owing it. But I had no fear of its properties and what to do with it and how to do it, you know, how to get it out of bank managers, really, if possible.
Which takes us to a very short break, and we're going to come back and we are actually going to continue talking about fear.
Visit a remarkable pub and drink well. Five Points Brewing Company proudly supply remarkable pubs with beers including Five Points Pale, XPA and Juper. Would you like to stock Five Points beers in your pub? Send Will an email. will@fivepointsbrewing.co.uk. Five Points are proud to supply remarkable pubs and would be proud to serve you.
I'm with Robert Thomas, and I'm building a picture of what drives you, Robert. When you've had a big obstacle in your life, mm-hmm. which you must have had, you know, you've been in business, you're a businessman, you're an entrepreneur, there must have been some big obstacles. What have you had? What's the inner strength that you could maybe share with listeners?
I've always found I've been able to become completely detached, and that comes from my education. Just from my education, able to become detached. So I never worry about that. You know, a total failure would never bother me. I would just come detached. And oddly enough, there's an old saying which something, one door closes, another one opens. And that's what's happened in my career every time. I mean, going from buses to pubs, I mean, totally different thing. Knew nothing about pubs, but I spotted an opportunity.
You use the word detached there. Does your swimming help you become detached from the business or in times of hardship?
Oh, well, yeah. If I go swimming and I don't have a care in the world afterwards, I think there's sort of some chemicals which, what are they called, endorphins or something, get released. Yeah, that's always a great release, going swimming. You come out feeling terrific, whatever's happened. I've had nasty things happen in business and where I've, just go for a swim and come out feeling. And detach yourself from the problem and think a positive way out of it. Don't let it get you down. There's always a way out somewhere, you know. I mean, even if it's bankruptcy, okay, that's a way out. And I think, as I say, once you've had an education, you know these things, don't you? And so you're able to detach.
So you've had a lot of, well, you call it luck, but then you corrected yourself to good judgment, and maybe it's just a blend of the two. If I was to ask other people to describe your faults, or if I was to ask you to describe your faults, what would you say they were?
Well, apparently I'm not a good listener at times, and I just overwhelm people with my thing without listening to them. And if I do that I consider that to be a fault. Sometimes people talk absolute tosh, and I know that they're wrong because I'm using my judgment for a problem, and I know that I'm right. I don't want to listen. It's wasting my time, you know. So I don't want to listen. Perhaps that's it. I don't know. But I've always tried to be polite and well-mannered to people if I can, and listen to what they have to say. But if it's tosh, you know, I cock a deafen, as they say, you know.
Is cocking a deafen stubbornness?
Might be, yeah, I don't know.
What other faults would you say that people would say? What other faults would you say that
goodness
you have? It's a difficult question.
I don't ever think about fault. I mean, I've made mistakes. You know, I've made mistakes. Which I regret. That's a fault, isn't it? Yeah, I suppose. Making the mistake. Lack of judgment in a certain doing. But I've always tried to be polite and not rude to people. So I've made mistakes, which is for errors of judgment, time to time.
Do you think you could have been more successful?
Much. Yeah. I'm a bit on the lazy side. A friend of mine the other day, interestingly, I wrote to him about this stuff we had, this success we've had with the Bullion and one thing or the other. It's been quite successful. Not making a fortune, but covering our costs, so, which I consider a success in that context up there. And then he wrote back, said, oh, you know, you should talk to J.D. Weatherspoon, what's his name, Martin, Mr. Martin, about your, you know, pointing out that you're just a little tiny minnow, a real pub business. And I wrote back, I said, yeah, but that's an industrial business. That's a big corporate enterprise. I'm not interested in that. You know, just not interested.
No. Like you weren't interested in the new model of bus. It
exactly.
didn't interest
so
you.
It didn't interest. What I'm interested in doing is finding buildings that have architectural merit and turning them back into something that people want to enjoy. I think it's the reverse of the sow's ear into a silk purse, isn't it?
I want to go back. I want to go back to a word that you just used, Robert. Mm-hmm. And you said that you were lazy. What does your interpretation of lazy?
Well, there are lots of opportunities I could have taken, and I thought, I can't be bothered. You know, laziness really. Good opportunities that I now regret. And I felt at the time, well, you're making a few quid. Let's go swimming, holiday, or something. You know, really. Yeah.
I've spoken to.
I was like that at school too. I mean, you know. Homework, couldn't do my homework, go swimming. I've always had a streak of laziness going through my...
Well, I've spoken to lots of people before we met today. Mm-hmm. Nobody described you as lazy, so it's interesting. It's interesting that you say that,
definitely lazy.
Maybe that held you back a little bit.
Maybe it explains why I don't want to become part of a corporate thing. Because you can't afford that level... What's his name, Martin?
Tim
Martin's level to go off the boil for any amount of time. You've got to have, you know, tremendous attention to detail, corporate finance, and so on and so forth. And something I wouldn't want to do because I'm too lazy. You know.
you talked about perhaps one of your faults not listening to people all the time, and you explained that really well. Somebody described you as having quite a small attention span. Maybe that's the same.
It's the same.
The
thing,
same type of thing. Yeah. But you have kept a focus on your business from the moment you bought the Prince George, right up to today. You know, you've recently bought another pub. Just before we turned the microphones on, you were telling me that there may be another one in the offing. So you keep. I would describe you as a completer finisher. You start something, you see it through to the end. Would you describe yourself as a...
Well, as far as the pubs go, it's a business. I've got to them. I've got, you know, bank to worry about, payments to worry about, bank loans. And although we don't actually at the moment have any of those things, but most throughout my career, we've always had some money, you know, which we've borrowed and had to repay.
Where is the finish for you?
Well, I know. 6 feet under, I suppose. Or when I've signed a document, what do they call those... things where you give responsibility.
Power of attorney.
Power of attorney to my daughter. When I've lost my marbles, I've told her to let me know when she thinks I have, and that's it. But I haven't yet, I don't think. I think about that every day, but I don't. My memory's going a bit, but I still feel up for it. I agree with Jean. We both agree that we bop till we dropped. I mean, there's nowhere else to do. What are you going to do?
So bop till you drop. Yeah. That's good. And... I just want to, you know, winding things up now. You live a thrifty life, I've noticed. You drive a practical car. You're wearing a very nice jacket today. Occasionally, you might wear a slightly older jacket, shall we say, with maybe a hole in the elbows. And I understand your respect for money, but it's not about money for you, is it?
I don't know what it is. Probably through some sort of political affiliations I had when I was a lot younger. But I dislike intensely consumer spending, you know, what do they call it? Conspicuous consumption, conspicuous spending. I don't like it at all. I hate it when people make a few quid and they suddenly turn up in a roller or something. And I know people like that. And I think, you know, I just don't like it.
No.
It somehow offends probably my Puritan sensibility. I think deep down there's Puritanism. In all of us in Britain, there's a Puritan person in a lot of British people. you know.
So is it about the money, or is it does money bring you security, or is it just not?
Oh, money is security. Yeah, that's the basic thing. Why I'm in business, to make sure I can always pay the gas bill, the mortgage, and so on and so forth. Mm. That's the essential thing. But now I kind of think I've moved on from there. I'm interested in these restorations. It's restoration. I've always been in restoration. My bus business was restoration. Mm. I'm still in it.
So you've got that side of things. So the money is separate. You love restoration. You'll take an old building, an old Victorian
old buildings.
Build, you'll turn it into something absolutely wonderful. You'll add that bit of DNA, which I was talking earlier on before you got here to the audience about how pub companies and other entrepreneurs have copied you. The one thing they can't get.
I've never noticed that.
Absolutely. Bare floorboards. So the way the pubs are presented in a simple way.
I've never been aware of anybody
cask conditioning.
I don't know.
Well, I can guarantee you that they have.
Yeah.
But there's also something else, I think, and this came up when I was doing my research with you, that you get a huge buzz out of seeing people in your pubs. And you may say to somebody, look what we did here. We've done this.
Yeah, I think that's a natural kind of feeling, isn't it? Most people get that, especially if they buy a house and decorate it themselves, and you know, they're proud of it.
Mm. But it's.
I do get tremendous satisfaction out of these restorations. I mean, the Boleyn Tavern was probably our pinnacle.
Yeah.
But I love what we've done there. It's a great thrill.
Rob, it's almost like two things. One, that you get a buzz out of seeing people enjoying themselves. You don't necessarily know who they are, but you can see them, the bon vivre of having a drink in a pub or having something to eat in a pub, and you can say, look at these people. This is what I've done with you,
great
Jake,
fun.
Or with you, Cess, or with you, Gene. Yeah. This is what I've done. But then there's also another side where you talked about not overtly showing your wealth or not overtly... It's not about that. However, you like to take your swimming friends, for example, to the Boleyn or to the Royal Inn and kind of say, look at this. What kind of...
Well, yeah, Boleyn, my swimming friends, chance to give them a free drink occasionally, you know, buy them a drink, that's all.
Is it to say, look what I've done?
I suppose it would have been, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a bit of that there.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, all individual athletes are show-offs in a way, aren't they? I mean, so if I can't beat him on 100 metres backstroke, look, I've got this instead. No, I don't know.
Do you know, I can't wait to hear this podcast back, because it's I'm learning a lot about you, but I'm a little bit confused as well. So,
well, what are you confused about? Tell me, and I'll relieve you of that burden.
Listen, I want to talk about advice for your kids, so for Leela and for Jake. At some point they will inherit this business of yours, this business worth a huge amount of money, created by you're not allowed to rustle the papers near the microphone. They will at some point inherit the business, of course. What is your advice to them? Do you want them to grow it? Do you want them to double it? Do you want them to treble it? Do you want them to keep it the same?
Yeah, I do, definitely. Yeah. Well, that's the only way to go in business. That you can't stop. I mean, you know, no, you've got to do that.
Hmm.
You never know what's going to happen around the corner, do you? You've got to keep going. My advice to them would be, if they get an idea, implement it and don't give up. And as I mentioned earlier, don't worry, if one door closes, another one opens.
Mm.
So always keep going.
So let's move forward. They've got your business.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want them to concentrate on... Jake is in the art world, Leela's in the music world, and they've got the pubs business. Do you want them to adopt what you've just said to their particular respective worlds, or do you want them to focus on the pub business and to grow that?
Enough time to do that on their respective businesses, and they know better than I what they can do. So I let them do whatever they want to do. But they've got the pub business as a anchor and as a source of income in order to expand their ambitions in those particular forms of endeavour. And I hope they do that if they want to. But they're fully aware of the impact on their lives of these pubs. I mean, they're fully aware of that. So I don't think they're bright kids. They're not going to do anything silly with
and
the
have
money.
You any advice to them? Because we talked earlier on about, you said there was no family money. Do you remember, for you,
yeah.
for your kids, you said there was no family money. There's family money for them.
Yeah.
Any advice on that? Any advice in, will they have the same appreciation of money?
Well, I hope so. And as I say, opportunities are everywhere. And the ability is to spot them and then act, not just say, oh, wish I'd done that.
Okay.
And I'm sure both of them watched me do all this stuff over the years, and sometimes I've seen them gape. You haven't done that. Yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fear creeps in. Yeah. But I know the situation financially, and they don't. So, yeah.
Robert, you've poured your heart and soul into your business. That's, you know, without doubt. At aged 80, just look back on your life, and how do you feel about your life?
Well, I've made mistakes like everybody else, and I have certain regrets like everybody else, I'm sure. Certain things I wish I hadn't done, which are personal, but there you are, do these things. Don't know why. Well, I do know why. Yeah, certain instability in my life when I was younger, which affected my judgment on personal matters, I think, at times.
Robert Thomas, Olympian swimmer, entrepreneur, owner of Remarkable Pubs. I'd like to thank you very much for
your
time.
Thank you very much for this opportunity of expressing my career.
Thanks, Robert.
Okay, that's it. I can't take this beer away because I'm on my motorbike, so you'll have to go and drink it.
Okay.